Now, there ain't nothing in the world to start your day like a good cup of coffee. And the best cup of coffee starts with freshly roasted beans. But did you know that most popular coffee brands have the mendacity to sell you coffee without revealing to you when it was roasted? Why, I think the practice is downright odious. Which is why I only drink Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabic beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends or roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this splendid coffee to your home or office or plantation within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And sure as sugar, you will taste the difference. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. And now Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you enter the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, you'll receive 10% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what I want to know is, have you got the guts to live and start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen? I beseech you to plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hiya, movie people, and thanks a heap for downloading the Next 121 Project, the every Monday podcast that peers back at classic motion pictures. Those peer backs are filled with spoilers. I am the big daddy of this podcast, Ryan Ellis, and here's the teensy tiny mama, my wife Bev.
That's me.
Before we get going on Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, I got a few corrections, or what I would call runs, hits, and errors. I do this with Chris on the Squaring at the Movies episodes, but this is for Red River. John Wayne is not wearing a black hat when he kills the Mexican guy early in the movie. I said he was. I thought for sure when I looked at a YouTube clip he was, but he's not. He's wearing a light-colored hat or even a white hat. It's black and white, so I assume it's white. It could be beige, for all I know. But he is wearing a black hat when they set off on the cattle drive, which is still early in the film, but Roger Ebert implied it was towards the end he's wearing a black hat. That being the subtle transition, but it is much earlier that he's wearing a black hat. So I was sort of right, but no. When he's killing the guy, white hat.
Even though it's arguably the most evil thing he does in that movie, takes a man's life to steal his land, to steal his boss's land. It's not even that guy's land.
Yeah, he's a messenger.
Yeah.
He's a bad man in that movie. Okay, then, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Paul Newman, Elizabeth Taylor, and writer-director Richard Brooks were all nominated for Oscars for the movie, but none of them won. Taylor and Brooks did win trophies soon after, and in the same year, in fact. Newman's win came much later, should have come much earlier, but it came in the 80s for Color of Money. In what year did Taylor and Brooks hear their names called?
They didn't have to wait very long. They won the awards in 1961 for their 1960 films. For Liz Taylor, it was Butterfield 8. And for Brooks, it was Elmer Gantry?
Elmer Gantry, Burt Lancaster movie.
I didn't write it down, and I was pretty afraid of just uttering a completely wrong movie, because I haven't seen either of those films, so they kind of don't really hold a lot of bearing in my mind.
I saw them both, but don't remember them all that well. Burt Lancaster won his only Oscar for acting in Elmer Gantry. He plays a revivalist preacher, what the hell you call that kind of thing, like the tent guys.
Like a missionary?
No, one of those.
Probably revivalist preachers, yeah.
I will fix you and your sins.
An evangelist.
Guy. There you go. I think I have that right.
So Brooks didn't win for directing. He only won for the screenplay,
for writing.
Right?
That's right. Yeah. Brooks was nominated, in fact, for 8 Oscars in total, including on In Cold Blood, a movie we covered a couple years ago. And I think he also was nominated for the Blackboard Jungle screenplay. We also covered that movie quite a few years ago. And he was certainly nominated for this movie twice, in fact. We'll get to those a little later on. Cat on a Hot Tin Roof was released by MGM. We haven't seen them that much the last couple of years, have we? A little over 60 years ago in August 1958. Two very big box office. The movie was a nice hit, a very big hit for MGM. But Bev, the movie is 60 years old, so explain it to our listeners with the skin.
Paul Newman is Brick Pollitt, a wealthy plantation heir and raging alcoholic, and Liz Taylor is Maggie, his undersex wife who needs to nut up and leave Brick like yesterday. Brick and Maggie are summoned to Brick's family home for his big daddy's birthday, where they learn that the old man has terminal cancer, leaving the fate of the family fortune in question, and amplifying the already explosive tension in the Pollitt family.
Or, in a nutshell, Former footballer foregoes fucking frisky feline.
Well done, sir.
Also known as his wife. Or alcoholism, the movie. Brick drinks and drinks and drinks and never really seems to get even tipsy, never mind drunk.
Well, sometimes he's drunk. When it's convenient, he acts completely wasted.
He does?
Well, like in the beginning of the film when he hurts himself.
Right, when he does the hurdles thing in the beginning of the movie, the East Mississippi High Athletic Grounds, which is a bit of a play on something that came later on. Well, this was before these other movies. No, sorry, it was after one of them and before the other one. Newman did the same kind of thing in a drunken pre-credits scene in Cool Hand Luke.
Yes.
Which was much later. Rebel Without a Cause, Jimmy Dean, played with this silly little toy and he was drunk and got thrown in jail. Now, of course, Brick doesn't go to jail, but anyway, these three movies all have drunken pre-credits kind of scenes.
And this film is guilty of a thing a lot of films are guilty of, which is that Brick is drunk when it's convenient, and then immediately sober when it's convenient. Like, he'll put back bottle after bottle of whiskey very conspicuously, and still be able to clearly deliver a witty comeback at the ready.
I can do that, too.
Not when you're drunk, you can't. Yeah. Not when you drink whiskey like this guy who looks like he's trying to drown himself in it.
I do like my mix. There's a little cola in there.
I don't want to speak for alcoholics. I'm just a casual drunk.
Not a pro like him.
I've never admitted that I have a problem, therefore I'm not an alcoholic. But real alcoholics don't advertise that they're drinking in the morning. He seems to want to aggressively display his drinking. But also, the amount he drinks could, honest to God, kill somebody. In every shot of him, it seems like he's finishing a glass of whiskey and refilling it.
Yeah.
If you were to play a drinking game where you merely took a sip every time that man reached for a bottle, then you would be in the hospital.
You'd be loaded before Big Daddy's birthday party even gets going.
You sure wouldn't be able to walk and clearly talk and reason with people and argue. And you probably would be much easier to ply into bed if you were.
Especially when your wife is Elizabeth Taylor.
No kidding!
Okay, so the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. You're not going to like this, because I know you're not a fan. 97% of critics like the movie, 34 fresh, only one rotten, and 93% of audiences. It is currently 8.1 on the Internet Movie Databases. Well, not top 250, because it isn't on the top 250, even though it does outrank other movies, because a lot of them are 8.0, I looked on the top 250. So this should be somewhere around 200. But this isn't on there, I guess, because it's limited votes. And South Pacific was the smash hit that year, far and away the biggest hit of 1958. Gigi, which won Oscars, a lot of them, in fact, and also did very well at the box office, was a competitor. But this is, I think, better than both those movies, but I don't think you agree with that, do you?
So, unpopular opinion here. This is a bad movie. I think it's objectively bad. Maybe the play is good. And had they left it intact instead of writing out the main motive behind all of Brick's bad behavior, it could have been good, but we'll never know. What we have is 2 hours of overwrought, wordy, melodramatic overkill. It's only buoyed by the sheer attractiveness of Taylor and Newman and some very good jibes at children in general, which I appreciated. But it's a bad movie. I don't care what Rotten Tomatoes says. What's redeeming about it? Liz Taylor and Paul Newman are just so watchable.
This is not her best work. There are a few overacted moments, but otherwise she's the best thing in the movie, I think, though. I think she was better. Everyone probably thinks she was better. And Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? We talked about Butterfield 8. That was her first Oscar. A lot of people said she won that because it sounded like she maybe was going to die. But then she won one 6 years later for a much better performance. Probably her best ever in Virginia Woolf.
Why was she going to die?
Because of her
alcohol abuse?
I don't know if it was that, but something was wrong with her.
Anyway. I know she was sick before they made this film. They remarked on how she lost a bunch of weight and she wasn't well, but I get the impression it was kind of like a bad flu or something.
She lived until, I don't know when it was, maybe only about 10 or 15 years ago, so she lived long past any of this era. And she is top billed. We've not watched that many movies where the woman is the top billed character. We saw this way more often in the AFI movies, and even some of the ones we've covered since, like His Girl Friday, they weren't AFI movies. That's a bad example, because Cary Grant was the top-billed actor. But old movies where maybe Katharine Hepburn, or Elizabeth Taylor in her prime, were the lead actor. Paul Newman really wasn't that big a star yet. He was going to be later on. Is this his best work? No, but he was nominated for Best Actor. We've covered Hood, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which was an AFI film. The Sting, The Hustler, The Color of Money, Chris and I covered that. Good in all those movies, and he's fine in this, but this is not one of his cool, lighthearted, charismatic performances we saw in most of those other movies. Well, maybe not so much The Hustler or even Hood. Although there is charisma in those movies, and this one, not really so much.
HUD, where he's a far worse person, he is more charismatic to watch.
You can see why people, like including his nephew, would be drawn to him, and why the women want to bone him. And you can see why they want to bone him in this because of his looks, but other than that...
This is a movie where everybody loves him, where the main conflict in the film or play is that everybody wants to love him so bad, but he pushes them away and acts like such an aggressive ass. But unlike HUD, where you're like, well, I get where the charm comes from, he's charmless. He's just mean. Why does his father love him best?
And he's not even the firstborn son. Gooper is the older son. Mama even says at one point, my only son, about Brick. While Gooper's in the room with him.
Poor Gooper! He does everything right. There's nothing really outwardly wrong with him. Yes, his wife is an insufferable shrew.
Shut up, May!
His kids are terrible. But Gooper, as he says in the film, I did everything you told me to do. I took over the family business. I got married. I had children. You're mad at Brick for not having children. I have a dozen of them.
And I'm the older son.
And I'm the older son. Why is it even a dispute that he should get the plantation? I don't understand this main conflict. Because they altered the play, perhaps that's why it doesn't work for me. Because when you take away the fact that Brick is gay, in the play, he is a homosexual. What's his friend's name?
Scooter? Skipper.
Skipper. Skipper was his lover.
Yeah.
They were in love. And then Skipper killed himself. Is that right?
Well, I don't know how the play went because I've never seen the play performed or read anything about the details of this. But the movie portrays that Maggie may have slept with him. That's what Brick thinks. So let's go on the notion in the movie that he's not a closeted homosexual.
And he's not playing it like he's gay. He's playing.
So we know that he should be. That's what the play should have been. But let's just forget that for a minute. So he's mad at Maggie for what he thinks is an affair with his best friend. So his wife and his best friend. But then in the movie he finds out, and she finally reveals, no, that's not what happened. His real guilt anyway, regardless of any of that, is that Skipper killed himself, which of course you can't control, but he didn't answer the phone. Brick didn't answer the phone. And then Skipper jumped out an 11-story hotel. So again, you have to forget what the play was, which is so important. Why is he so worked up about this? Anybody would feel guilt about not answering that telephone or not helping out the friend. We've heard this in so many walks of life where somebody says the friend or the brother or the mother or whatever they were to you killed themselves and they tried to contact you or you didn't contact them or I was going to text them and I didn't do it. Everyone feels bad about that kind of thing.
Yeah, but they don't drink themselves to death over it.
Right, because they needed to have the real subtext in the movie.
So let's get back to self-loathing.
Yeah, so he's self-loathing for something that's bigger than that because he doesn't want to sleep with this wife and they cast this gorgeous woman. I don't know what they did on the stage. I never felt like Elizabeth Taylor was the most beautiful woman in Hollywood history, even though a lot of people say she was. But she certainly is great looking and she seems pretty cool too on top of all that. So she's beautiful and she's smart and she seems like she's, got it, she's a pretty awesome chick.
I mean, Big Daddy just loves her.
1 second, I'll get to that in a minute. But Maggie has a lot of disdain for her nieces and nephews outwardly. But she wants her own kid, which is a bit of an irony there. Gooper and May are making up for Brick and Maggie's lack of kids by having 5 kids and another one on the way. But yes, when Big Daddy sees her at the airport, her specifically, because everyone goes to the airport except for Brick. Get out of my way, grandkids. Get out of my way, son and daughter-in-law. And well, his wife is with him on the plane. Oh, it's Maggie. Yeah. And it isn't implied that he is interested in Maggie that way. He just likes her and loves her as his daughter-in-law.
I think they're the only two people in the entire film who like each other. Big Mama loves Brick. People love Brick. Brick doesn't love anybody.
They all love Brick.
But the only mutual love relationship is between Maggie and Big Daddy. And it just makes you think, oh, why couldn't they just be together? They seem like they would actually make a great
couple. Spin-off movie.
Maggie can dote on him the last year of his life and take care of him and then collect all the money and Big Daddy would get to spend the last year of his life married to someone he doesn't have outright contempt for no reason. I don't know why he hates Big Mama so much. Everybody in this movie hates their spouse so much.
I think maybe the problem is they live on a plantation with black servants and it's not too far removed from them all being slaves. Now maybe in
you're
the
50s... You're saying that the rich white people are slaves?
No, the black servants are not that far removed from being slaves.
I thought you were like, it's meant to be the theme. Yes, that's true.
Now, maybe Tennessee Williams picked up on that, or maybe he wasn't picking up on that. He was from the South, so maybe he didn't care about the subtext there. But then he put it in his own play, so he must have picked up on that. It's not a big part of the movie. We don't see the servants very often in the film. They're not, well, they have speaking roles, I guess, but they don't really have very many lines, or they're not that important. But maybe that's part of the problem, is these people realize what they do is not cool. They're on a plantation In the South?
Although, the plantation was purchased, I guess, by Big Daddy. It's not like they come from a long line of plantation owners, because Big Daddy's own father was a hobo, and they rolled the rails together, and he talks about growing up poor. Who knows how he worked his way to owning a plantation? It seems like a weird career path, but he is a self-made man, so they don't actually have a personal legacy in antebellum slavery.
Yeah, that's true. It's become pretty jarring, and I know you'll agree, when we see Confederate flags brandished so proudly in movies. And yeah, it's 60 years later, so it's easy to say this now. The Dukes of Hazzard is a show I've not seen in a long time. I loved it as a kid. But it would be hard to watch that now because the Confederate flag is on the roof of the car.
And I think many people would say, yeah, it's about time that we started seeing that symbol for what it is.
I did not really think about that until a little more recent history, the last couple of years, when
we
they talked about it.
We weren't forced to think
in
about
South
it.
Or North, I think it was South Carolina, one of those two at least, where they took it off the state capitol. Nikki Haley, before she was the UN ambassador, was the governor, I believe, of one of those two states, and that became a thing, and she took it down, and everyone applauded that, and I heard that and thought, okay, great, I just honestly didn't know that was such a symbol. I should have realized, I guess.
Well, but I knew what the symbol was. I didn't know that, God, this is going to sound so ignorant and white, but I thought everybody had just kind of forgiven it. And I hadn't really thought about it, because it just didn't cross my path, because I'm a white lady that lives in Canada. And it wasn't until that happened, and Black Lives Matter, and then suddenly everybody being like, oh yeah, and by the way, you fly in the flag of the rebellion forces who lost the war, by the way, and were fighting strictly for the right to keep humans as slaves. That is such an insult in the face of the Black Southerners, who are Americans, and have every right, have as much heritage as you have in those states. As soon as I started paying attention to that, because we were forced to,
it seems obvious now.
It's like I'm embarrassed for how little thought I actually put into that symbol.
I think the reason why is because it's so similar to the American flag. Red, white, and blue, stars, and I guess some stripes. I can't picture the flag right now, but anyway, the flags are similar enough.
We don't learn Civil War history in Canada, so right. I think I just kind of remained somewhat ignorant other than the broad strokes.
But it really stands out to watch a movie like this now. But speaking of color, how about no color? It's appropriate that Brick wears a gray suit in his first scene. He's a shades of gray kind of guy. He isn't truly a bad guy like he was in HUD with charisma, or a good guy like he is in most movies, although Paul Newman played his fair share of, if not bad guys, then not so good guys. The touch I like the most, though, is a line. I always remember this line so well, that he drinks until he hears that click in his head. That's a line that always resonated with me.
It is to soothe the deep self-loathing or like some deep emotional lack that they have to cover up or forget about.
But do you ever hear a click in your head when you've had too much to drink at night? I don't, but I just like that notion, that concept, even the literal hearing a click if he actually does.
I think the difference between me and Brick is that my click comes after one drink. You know, I just want to take the edge off after the end of a long day. And then once I've had two drinks, then another click goes off that says, all right, that's enough. If you have any more, you're going to hate yourself tomorrow. And frankly, I don't even enjoy the feeling of being woozy drunk.
But you don't listen to it a lot of the time, and neither do I.
Well, listen. It depends on what I'm doing. For instance, if I'm singing karaoke.
That's different.
All that bets, click is a totally different
all
click.
Bets are off. But his marriage to Maggie is a tough one to watch because you've got these two really good actors who I think got along pretty well behind the scenes. But we're not really hitting it out of the park, which I guess is the play. Maybe they're acting the play exactly the way it was written. I read somewhere that Tennessee Williams, of all the plays he ever wrote, this was his favorite. Oh, now, I don't know if it was a favorite adaptation of one of his plays, but the play itself was one of his favorites, or was his favorite. I do think you have to admire horny Maggie's loyalty, not to take a lover, because she wants so much action, and she's getting none, at least this one day.
This whole film, I'm just like, run, girl. You're hot. You'll find another rich man. I'm pretty sure Big Daddy would turn up Big Mama and spend his last years with you, and you'd be pretty well taken care of. Or I'm sure he has rich buddies that would love to trophy up with a wife like you. I don't understand why she puts up with Brick, although she does have the line where she talks about how her father was a drunk, just like Brick. It's just that way that the love we're brought up with is the love that we feel comfortable accepting. That's how we see family as being, and therefore it is what we seek out and what we foster.
This is also the patriarchy, and it's her job to stay with her husband, isn't it?
That's not what she says with her husband, though. There's nothing in her many, many, many monologues that are lamenting on how she's obligated to stay with him because of her marriage vows. It is not that. It is the fact that he is still just as hot, if not hotter, than he was the day she married him. It's because she loves him. That poor woman.
She wants to break him and get him into bed. And then she does at the end, at least it's implied, that when the movie's ending, they're about to finally go to bed together. Why does she lie about her pregnancy at the very end? We're skipping way ahead here. Because now they have to have sex. There's a fake kid scenario in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf that is played out at the very end of that movie. Now we've got a not fake kid, but they actually have to have a real one. We don't have to, I guess. But then Brick is agreeing with Maggie. Yeah, she's actually pregnant. Again, the second son now suddenly has a birthright because his wife is pregnant, but she's not really, but he's going to have to do it now and put a baby in her.
Big Daddy's reaction is, I'm calling the lawyer tomorrow. We're drawing up a new will. That's his first reaction. Poor Gooper. Could you imagine? And May, as awful as she is just over
Shut up,
the
May.
Top awful. She
Shut
is.
Up, May.
She calls her a liar right to her face, and you're like, that's really obnoxious, but she's right. She is a liar. Although you're like, May, did you just have dozens of children so that you could inherit the plantation? Is that your motive for having this army of singing, filthy monster children?
Can't the family see that Big Daddy might be okay with all of them if they just shut up for even 2 minutes? Stop singing every 2 minutes.
My main problem with the film, the play, I don't know, the whole act of creation here is overkill, and they are so guilty of overkill with May. That actress played May also on Broadway, on stage.
3 of her first 4 movies were Tennessee Williams plays as well, adaptations.
Wow. She's awful. I know she's supposed to be awful. I know you're probably thinking in your head, yeah, she's supposed to be intolerable.
Could be a Sandy Dennis thing, again, Virginia Woolf, yes. Because she's pretty awful too, and if it weren't for a few moments, the one we talked about in that podcast a few years ago, when she comes down the stairs and she hears them talking, and Sandy Dennis plays a moment of, okay, I gotta turn it back on again, I gotta be honey again. Where enough that 1-4 seconds or even less, maybe the whole performance is annoying. It is annoying anyway, but it might be even more annoying.
Then when you learn that this is something that she's putting on to be likable or just get through her day,
well, we don't have that with
suddenly
May.
Turns into a tragedy.
But not having that with May maybe hurts the performance
and
a lot.
And May, this is mean, but
it's not a good performance.
Deeply homely. She is a very unattractive
Madeline
woman.
Sherwood they cannot compete with Elizabeth Taylor.
They make her look as bad as possible, and then it is just her either yelling at her kids, yelling at her husband, talking over everybody, being a dictionary definition of the word shrew as often as possible. There's nothing remotely redeeming about her. Gooper should be the hero of this story. He's the real put-upon person in this story. He's the real tragedy.
Well, Jack Carson is Gooper. He's the originator of the Jack Carson Grinning Idiot School of Acting, which you didn't see in this movie. I've talked about this in a lot of our podcasts before because we've had other actors who will do this. I love Double Indemnity, one of my favorite movies of the 40s, one of my favorite movies ever. But there's a moment in that movie I never liked very much. And Fred McMurray says to Edward G. Robinson something like, why don't you, for instance, about getting a wife and kids and everything? And the way he's grinning at him, it just seems so phony. And Jack Carson doesn't do it in this movie, but in so many other supporting player movies he did around this time, the 50s and I think even back in the 40s. He does that whole sort of grinning idiot thing. You have to watch the movies that he's done to know. I looked up his movies. I didn't really find anything that was all that noteworthy that he was in, but I know I've seen him in a lot of movies, and I always think of him as the guy who did that grinning idiot thing. He died just a few years later at 52 years old, too, after this movie, so he wasn't very old at all.
No.
But yeah, he is the unsung hero of the family. He's fine in the movie, and I do like the moment towards the end where he says to about Brick, do you think I'm actually trying to screw you over? And Brick says no, and they have this little brother moment, because people rarely in this movie actually truly connect, like you said. Maggie and Brick almost never do. Brick and his father in the basement, of course, do towards the end of the movie. And by the way, that basement, the Citizen Kane basement.
Yes.
Sell some of that stuff and give the money to your servants. I don't know. You have all this crap down there that Brick destroys, which, of course, Big Daddy didn't know he was going to do. But still, you have all this wasted money. And, of course, that's the point. You've got all this wealth. And obviously the movie's going for that
kind
of thing.
What does wealth buy you?
Just like Kane had this warehouse of nothing. But, yeah.
And also, just in case you didn't get it yet, there has to be like a giant life-size picture of Brick playing football in this big conquering hero pose, but to throw the football, another real subtle touch there, guys.
Well, his job is as a sports announcer. He was a hurdler and a football player in school, and then he has a broken ankle from doing the stupid stuff with the hurdles at the beginning of the film. He actually gets around pretty well considering that broken ankle is not even a full day old yet, too.
Well, who's feeling pain when they've had a
Maybe that's
swimming
why.
Pool's worth of whiskey?
Maybe that's a subtlety in the movie. That could be what it is, because otherwise, Why is he able to get around on that?
I don't think it's subtlety. I think it's just convenience. When they want him to be able to get around, they just let him get around. When they want him to seem like he's really lame and falling over because he's trying to quote-unquote kill Maggie, then it's convenient for him to be lame in one scene and able-bodied in another.
What did you think of the chemistry between Newman and Taylor?
Of course there's chemistry. There have rarely been two better-looking people to grace the screen or humankind at all. I think any chemistry that they did have was marred by the fact that their conflict was forced and inauthentic.
Because his, he should have been a gay man, and he's not. Yeah,
his loathing for her didn't come from a hurt place. Like, if it was that he thought that she seduced his best friend, then he should have been playing it like someone whose heart was broken, but he wasn't. He was playing it like somebody who had contempt for her for no reason that was really clear from her performance or his. So the chemistry was wasted. And then when they finally get together at the end, all you can think is, oh dear God, don't have a child. That's the worst thing you two could do. You hate each other. Or he hates her. Them having a child would be an absolute tragedy.
Does Brick forgive Maggie when he hears the truth about Skipper? Because he does seem to be a little lighter with her after that.
I guess, honestly, his character didn't make much sense to me. He just seemed mean for no reason. Maybe it's because I knew what he was supposed to be in the play, and I knew that they were trying to find some way around that.
Now, you'd never seen this movie before this viewing. Did you know about that going in? Did you read about that or hear about that going in, that he's supposed to be a gay guy who's actually married to what?
Which I think is what ruined it for me, because I knew that he was supposed to have a relationship with Skipper and that he was gay, and that's where the whole thing came from. All I could see was them trying to foolishly try to work around that. It's like trying to make Rent, but the producer's saying, okay, but you can't acknowledge the disease AIDS. Now go make a film. And it's like, you're going to ruin it because it's just such a big part of that play. You take homosexuality out of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and you have to ask, why are you making this film at all if you're going to leave out the most important thing that the play was saying? That homophobia makes this person destroy his own life out of self-loathing. His friend kills himself and he is killing himself slowly with alcohol.
He's not diving out of a hotel window, but he's doing it slowly. I felt like in this viewing at least that the Cat in a Hot Tin Roof reference, which she actually says during the movie, could just as easily have been walking on eggshells. Because she's walking eggshells with Brick for sure. And everyone seems to be walking eggshells with Brick and with Big Daddy. Brick and Big Daddy have a lot in common. Maybe the best scene in the movie is also the worst scene in the movie. It's one of those films you could say Rocky IV is both a great movie and a terrible movie. And that is the long scene in the basement with Brick and Big Daddy. Burl Ives. Yeah, exactly. That line said a lot. Mendasty, which is lying, for those who don't know what that word means. But Burl Ives plays Big Daddy. He won an Oscar the same year for The Big Country. It's probably one of those awards where he won it for being good in multiple movies. I don't remember The Big Country. I saw it. I forget entirely what he did in that film. He also is the guy who sang Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer in that TV movie.
Oh, yeah.
If you recognize the voice.
I think that's where I know the name Burl Ives from. Because this is probably the first Burl Ives movie I've ever seen. But I'm like, I know that name from somewhere. That's it.
So even though Newman and Taylor are the legends now, Taylor probably already was a bit of a legend, and Newman was going to become that soon after this. Burl Ives, I said Maggie's the best thing in the movie, but maybe it actually is Big Daddy, and that long scene he has with Brick in the basement, it has the stupid scene where he's breaking his stuff. Not so much stupid, I guess, but just that whole wastefulness, I guess, bothered me, which is just kind of dumb, because they're not thinking that way. But they do finally connect in that basement scene. What do you think of that part of the movie? Because without that, the movie has nowhere to go. It has to be that Brick forgives and connects with Big Daddy.
So I agree that Burl Ives is incredibly charming and his presence adds a lot to the film. And every scene that he's in is a better scene just because of his gregariousness, his bombacity. His energy is so good. And he's funny as well. The way he is with his grandkids, he's terrible. And it's actually very refreshing every time him and Maggie are in a scene together because they just seem to have so much genuine love for each other. And even though it's fully acknowledged that he finds her attractive, everything's above board between them. I agree that I enjoy his performance. I disagree that the scene in the basement, maybe it's a good scene, but by the time that finally happens, I was so checked out of any investment in the characters in the film and the story itself that I kind of was at that point, I hate to say it, I just wanted it to be over. And I just didn't buy it. Did you feel emotionally invested in that scene? Was there any part of you, as a person who's had your own struggles with your relationship with your dad?
Yes.
You emotionally connected with that scene?
That's why.
Oh, so maybe that's it.
He and I are better than we used to be by a lot. My dad is also on borrowed time because he's in his 70s now and has all kinds of health troubles. And then Big Daddy in this movie is on borrowed time. The doctor lies to everyone, including to Big Daddy, about the man's health, but he tells Brick. It's funny how Brick is such a linchpin in this family because Brick does all he can to renounce the inheritance that he doesn't even deserve because he's not the firstborn son. But then he is there to begin with, birthday party or not. He's there. He doesn't need to be there, but he goes there anyway. If he hates the family so much, then just stay away.
Well, I get the impression that Maggie dragged him there.
He didn't have to go, though. He didn't have the broken ankle until the night before. They obviously got there before that. She didn't literally make him get in the car and say, well, you can't drive anywhere else. He was physically able when they went there.
Big Daddy's like, well, I had a birthday last year and the year before. You guys didn't show up.
So I think Brick maybe is interested in that inheritance, and that's part of the conflict. I'm assuming that Tennessee Williams and Richard Brooks knew all these things. I hope so. And that's the levels and the details. There was, and this is one of the influences of this movie, a National Theater live performance earlier this year with Sienna Miller and Jack O'Connell. So as hot as Newman and Taylor were in their prime physically, Sienna Miller and Jack O'Connell, maybe she's past her prime, but wow, in her prime at least. That probably was more honest the way this was actually supposed to be. It's probably about the gay subtext.
I think Scarlett Johansson has also played Maggie the Cat, and she might be, when she wants to be, one of the sexiest women who have ever been in Hollywood.
Yeah, it's not just about physicality. It's more about embodying something. And Taylor had it, not as much as I think a lot of people think she did, but definitely had it. Sienna Miller really has it.
Yeah, there are actresses who can play hot and desirable, and then there's actresses who can play horny.
Or can play that quality that you can't. At least for me, I can't speak for other men. A lot of people might say Elizabeth Taylor does that for them, and she never really did for me. Halle Berry, I've said many times to you, objectively is one of the prettiest women who's ever been on a movie screen, but as far as that whole sort of quality, no. She's never had that for me. There are way worse looking women than her in Hollywood who have that feeling for me, and Sienna Miller, who's not way worse looking, by the way, does have that kind of thing. And I talked about influence. Here are the other ones, TV and movies, in fact, that were made on the same story. The Cat in the Hot Tin Roof story was done in 1976 on TV with Laurence Olivier as Big Daddy and Natalie Wood as Maggie. Again, I don't know if she really has that oomph quality, pretty as she was. And the TV movie also in 1984 with Tommy Lee Jones as Brick and Jessica Lange as Maggie.
Jessica Lange, I can see it.
Especially in the 80s. And those two did Blue Sky together 10 years later. Lange won an Oscar for that movie as Best Actress. So I guess to wrap up, the basement scene and then the last bit of the movie where the lie about her being pregnant and then the film ends where they're going to finally consummate this marriage. Well, they probably consummated, but they're finally going to have a baby. I connected with it to a degree. I like the movie more than you did, by the way. I don't think I really said that early on. I don't think the movie's wonderful. 8.1 on the IMDb is a little bit strong, partly because the acting is a little bit, well, maybe more so the screenplay, and maybe it's the play's fault for that matter, is too on the nose, a little bit shrill. And like I said, Taylor is very good in the movie, but she's not consistently good. There's a few moments, and that's probably just because she has some dialogue that's a little bit silly to read. But overall, I connected with those three main characters, and I definitely felt for Jack Carson, especially in that one moment where it's asking his brother, what do you think, I'm trying to screw you over? No, I don't think that. And that was a well-played moment. And by the way, their mother is Judith Anderson, who is in Rebecca. She's great as the bad guy in that. And then the Vulcan priestess in Star Trek III. She's pretty good as Big Mama. Well, maybe not pretty good. Because Carson has a few moments where he's good. And yeah, they're playing the play. Maybe it's the play's fault. But Carson and Anderson and Sherwood, Larry Gates, the doctor as well, they don't stand out the way the three main leads do. And I think that Newman and Taylor and Ives redeem this as much as they possibly can. It's a chamber piece. It's a pretty simple kind of deal. This man's dying, and the one son loves him, but the father doesn't love him back. And the other son has complicated feelings. He loves him, but doesn't really love him the way he's supposed to. And the father loves him eternally and loves the man's wife eternally. But one of them, at least, doesn't want to give that back. But when the play ends, maybe a little bit too neat, in fact.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
He gives it back, and he maybe shouldn't.
I think I said when we first turned it off after the credits rolled, and then you asked me, what did you think of that? I said it was 2 hours of watching actors stare off into the same direction while arguing with one another. It felt like a play.
The poster's like that.
Yeah, two people both staring out the same window.
One of them with a drink in his hand.
One of them with a drink in his hand having a devastating argument with one another. It felt too much like watching a play, because that is exactly the kind of staging that you would do if you were staging a play. All the audience is sitting on one side, so the actors, you know, if you want to see their faces, they have to face in the same direction. And it's also really confined into that one set, it feels. A little claustrophobic. The way that plays turned into movies often feel.
It's mostly in Brick and Maggie's bedroom.
And on note of the play, I remember you were surprised that I'm the one that wanted to see this film because I had never seen it and it was a classic.
I first suggested it, but I was actually trying to backtrack and pick something
else.
Yes,
you were trying to talk me
out
of it.
And you almost insisted.
Yes, absolutely, because I have seen The Glass Menagerie on the stage and we saw Streetcar Named Desire. I really enjoyed both of those. I thought, look at this cast, Tennessee Williams. How have I never seen this film? I've just got to get it seen. I hated it. But I feel blasphemously like I want to criticize the dialogue a lot. I had a real problem with the wordiness of the dialogue. There's a lot of telling instead of showing. People just say their feelings out loud, but not only that, they do it over and over again. I even picked this one great line for an example during one of Maggie's many monologues. If you Google Maggie the Cat monologue, it's half of the movie. But the line goes, "You can be young without money, but you can't be old without it." It's a great, concise line that says a lot about where she's coming from and just the nature of the world. But then he can't just leave well enough alone, this beautifully constructed sentence. It starts, "You can be young without money, but you can't be old without it. You've got to be old with money, because to be old without it is just too awful. You've got to be one or the other, either young or with money. You can't be old and without it." It's so repetitive. I didn't make that up. I copied it directly from the IMDb page. And that's what I'm talking about. And this is why I just lost interest. I got bored. It was so repetitive.
What if it's possible that Richard Brooks and his co-writer James Poe, who won an Oscar actually for Around the World in 80 Days a few years before this actually, added that stuff? I don't know. Speculating right now, but maybe they added the stuff you didn't need to hear.
3 times the words needed to get the point across. And this isn't even addressing the fact that the film comes back again and again to Maggie lamenting how necessary money is to live and how afraid she is of being poor, how Brick is going to need money too and should care about this. Their fights in their room are 1 5-minute fight that goes on for 30 minutes of content of the film.
Brooks also wrote and directed Blackboard Jungle, which we covered a couple years ago, and In Cold Blood, which we loved, and had those 8 Oscar nominations in total. What a weird threesome. They did more movies than that. The Professionals, a Western. We probably should watch it because you love the Westerns. But just those 3 that we've covered now, Blackboard Jungle wasn't bad, but it had a lot of flaws. In Cold Blood was great in almost every way. And obviously you didn't like this very much.
Some directors are as good as the teams that they're working with.
Yeah, and I really do wonder if he butchered a play or if Williams' play wasn't all that great, despite the fact that Williams thought it was so good. Their producer was Lawrence Weingarten, who did Adam's Rib and Pat and Mike in his career before this, so he was obviously a Hepburn and Tracy guy. And yeah, right, this is a photograph stage play, largely. They have the main bedroom with Maggie and Brick. They have the living room, a little bit outside, but it doesn't really need to be opened up much more than that. They're at the airport. I mean, there's a lot of scenes all over the whole house and the grounds, but it is mostly just in that bedroom where anything really matters. In fact, at one point, they're all in Maggie and Brick's bedroom. The movie's 185:1. We watched the DVD. It's okay for a movie so old. Cinematographer William Daniels, who worked for nearly 50 years and shot 163 movies and won an Oscar for The Naked City. Naked. The editor was Ferris Webster. I love this guy's credits. The Magnificent Seven, The Manchurian Candidate, and The Great Escape, all in the span of a couple of years. And then this film, too, which is, I guess, pretty well edited. And the composer Charles Wolcott did the music, Blackboard Jungle also, and worked on Pinocchio and Bambi many years before for Disney. So what do you think of those technical people, the shooting, the cutting, and the music?
Well, the music wasn't in your face, so no objections there. The editing, I just don't think an editor could have saved this film. There's some films that an editor can save. Maybe could have trimmed down some of their repetition.
Did it feel slow? Well, there you go, I guess, cut out the repetition.
Yeah. I mean, scene by scene, I think they played out okay, but I personally would have been pretty tempted to cut out some of the points that are made over and over again, as I make that point again and again and again.
Well, the movie was nominated for 6 Oscars, including 4. Daniels' cinematography. It was also nominated for Best Picture, up against Gigi, which won Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, Newman and Taylor, of course, and the screenplay by Brooks and Poe. Gigi, which is not a very good movie, I haven't seen that in a long time, won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Cinematography, and also won 5 others.
I guess 58 wasn't like a great year, was it?
That's the year of Vertigo, but it was nominated for only sound and the sets.
Well, I also have an unpopular opinion about Vertigo, so...
But for most people, especially film critics, go back in time, that wins 20 awards probably.
I mean, it's a better movie than this. There's no question about that. Gigi I've never seen, so I can't speak on it.
Thank heaven for little girls.
Creepy.
That's where that song originated, I think. Well, it's in that movie at least. Cat on a Hot Tin Roof was nominated for no AFI lists at all. I had to double check that. I thought for sure it was at least nominated for the Passions list. Would you not agree? At least you've been nominated for the Passions list. The movie's filled with passion.
No, I don't agree, because I think it should be a good movie to be nominated for any of the lists. Although I am surprised that it does as well as it does on IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes and still didn't get nominated for any AFI list. No, they really snubbed it.
Well, I liked it more than you did, but I do understand why you have issues with it. It certainly isn't perfect. It certainly isn't Streetcar Named Desire, which Williams is probably best known for.
And which overall. I love.
And Newman and Taylor have been better in other things. Around that same time, Newman was still becoming a star. Taylor had already been a star. We covered her in A Place in the Sun, and Giant was before this, and whatever issues you have. Well, Giant, I think, is a good movie, but a great performance by her. One of her better performances, and it was only a few years before this.
If I had to choose to watch one or the other, I would watch Giant again, for sure.
And you did not like Giant a lot,
either. I didn't like Giant a lot, but I think this is an objectively bad movie. If I ever have to watch it again, I'm just going to have to match Brick drink for drink to get through it.
I'll try right now. Click, click, click. No,
not yet.
It's not late enough in the night yet. When we return with the next 122 project in 7 nights, we'll be kicking off Scary Movie Month with our first of 4 horror movies. We've already watched it and it scared the daylights out of Bev. It'll be the 3-year-old Fright Fest, It Follows.
It scared the daylights out of me, and it was the second time I'd watched it.
We saw it in the theater the first time.
Even the scary parts that I knew were coming still absolutely terrified me.
The subtext in this, and I think maybe all the movies we're going to cover in October, as I recall, all with female leads, too. So much detail. This movie's not very long. The podcast might be more than half as long. That's kind of my unwritten rule. I don't want the podcast to be more than half as long as the movie, and it certainly shouldn't be anywhere near as long as the movie. Fahrenheit 9/11 broke that rule a few weeks ago. We were more than half as long as the movie, but that was more about Trump. But It Follows. There's so much stuff in that. We'll talk about that in 7 days. And it looks like, by the way, we're not going to have to take some time off because after It Follows, we have a week off for Thanksgiving. We're going to be moving. We haven't done that yet, but we're going to be moving soon. And we think we can probably keep our schedule, which is nice because we've got some great movies in October we want to cover for Horror Movie Month, or Scary Movie Month,
We're working ahead for you, listeners.
So the coming attraction is trivia for It Follows. What's your favorite, if you have sex, you die, horror movie? And there are a lot of them.
All right, so for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about It Follows. But what if you can't wait till then? Well, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Lots of fun stuff for you there. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, you can check out our entire roster. We've covered hundreds of movies now, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made. Every episode is available for free, but perhaps in exchange, you would like to give us a rating and a review. That means a lot to us, so much, in fact, that if you leave a review and you maybe make a reasonable suggestion of a movie that we haven't covered that you would like to hear us talk about, we will take it under serious consideration. And if you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're pretty easy to find. We're both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code top100project at checkout. All one word, top100project, and it is not case sensitive.
Enough of this mendacity. Wait, we weren't lying at all, so enough of this truthfulness.
And cut.